Vladimir Lenin gets credit for saying the goal of socialism is communism. Socialism was once a dirty word in America, but today it's gone mainstream.
The establishment is terrified of that word, socialism.
Are we seeing more and more people identifying as socialists?
Absolutely.
And we've seen this increase in candidates identifying as democratic socialists.
We have to say yes to socialism, to the word and everything.
There is no doubt about it. Socialist ideas are spreading in America. Universal health care, free college, guaranteed basic income, free housing. It's undeniable that these Marxist ideas are growing in popularity. Which has to make you wonder, how is socialism spreading? I'm Patrick Kurelchi.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
Openly desiring socialism was once taboo in America, and for good reason. The goal of socialism is communism, and communism is antithetical to the American system because it forfeits our freedom. As Ayn Rand once said, quote,
"There is no difference between communism and socialism, except in the means of achieving the same ultimate end. Communism proposes to enslave men by force, socialism by vote. It is merely the difference between murder and suicide."
These Marxist ideologies are about enslavement, the opposite of American liberty. So how on earth is socialism spreading in our country? To find the answer, we're going to tell the story of perhaps the greatest American storyteller that's ever lived, Walt Disney. His journey shows how socialism has become so popular in our country and what we need to do to reverse the trend. Walt Disney was on the front lines of America's culture war before most of you were even born. The cartoonist could see that Marxists were infiltrating Hollywood, and he did something that is near extinct today in that godforsaken company town. He took action to expose them.
And I feel that they really ought to be smoked out and shown up for what they are, so that all the good free causes in this country, all the liberalisms that really are American, can go out without this taint of communism. That's my sincere feelings on it.
Walt Disney was one of the most prominent anti-communists of his time. He not only resisted their attacks on his company and American culture, but he went on offense, promoting middle American values as the cornerstone of a healthy society.
The one thing is that, to me, the important thing is the family. And if you can keep that family together with things, and that's been the backbone of our whole business, catering to the families.
Unlike most studio heads that came to Hollywood via New York, Walt was from the heartland. He had the kind of tenacity that you can't teach. Walt's early failures would have broken most men. He was a mediocre artist, an even less skilled businessman, but he never gave up, and he stuck around long enough to become a master storyteller, perhaps the best America has ever produced.
Walt Disney was born on December 5th, 1901, in a northwest Chicago community called Hermosa. He was the fourth of four boys. A sister would follow 2 years later. It wasn't long before their Chicago neighborhood started getting rough. So Walt's father, worried that the area would rub off on his sons, began searching for a better environment to raise his family. And he found it on a farm in Marceline, Missouri. In 1906, when Walt was barely 4 years old, they packed up and made the move. Marceline deeply impacted Walt's future American ideals. He loved the farm. He thought of it as a paradise, and much of the aesthetic found in his future films and even Disneyland itself find their roots in Marceline. It was there that Walt took an interest in drawing. His father, a Christian socialist, subscribed to a socialist newspaper called Appeal to Reason. Every week when the paper arrived, Walt would copy the illustration on the front cover.
They always had a front page cartoon of capital and labor, Walt recalled. When I was trying to draw, I had them all down pat.
In 1911, the family moved again to Kansas City, Missouri, where Walt took an art course. While in Kansas City, he helped with the paper route that his father purchased. Walt had to wake up at 4:30 a.m. every morning before school to deliver the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times. As a result, he'd often fall asleep in class because of the early hours. The Disney family bounced around. In 1917, they moved back to Chicago, and that's where Walt finished school. He became a cartoonist for his high school newspaper and added another art class to his belt. At a young age, he'd already found his thing. A year later, in mid-1918, Walt made a move rarely seen in modern America. With World War I still in progress, he wanted to join the fight against the Germans. So he attempted to enlist in the Navy. They rejected him because of his age. He was only 16. But that didn't stop him. He got smart. A few months later, after his mother notarized his birth certificate, he changed his 1901 birth date to read 1900, and then enlisted in the Red Cross Ambulance Corps. It worked. Within a few months, he was shipped off to France to catch the tail end of the conflict. But while he was overseas, Walt never gave up his love for cartooning. He would decorate the side of his ambulance with drawings and even had some of his work published in a military publication. When he returned from service in October 1919, his father offered him a job at a jelly factory in Chicago, of which he was part owner. Walt declined. He wanted to go a different route. He made his way back to his high school town of Kansas City, Missouri. And this is really where Walt started his epic career.
Walt wasn't sure if he wanted to be an actor or an artist. He turned to his brother Roy for advice. 9 years as senior, Roy was working as a clerk at a bank in downtown Kansas City. Apparently, Roy's colleague had heard about a local advertising company looking for an art apprentice. He told his kid brother he should give it a shot. Walt applied and got the job. He started in October 1919 and quickly met one of the most consequential people in his life, a talented artist by the name of Ub Iwerks. Good luck at guessing the origin of that name. Well, the job was short-lived. As the story goes, the company lost an account and laid Walt off after just 6 weeks. But in that brief time, he learned a few tricks of the commercial trade, and he also connected with the artist that would help him create one of the most prolific characters in American history. A few weeks after Walt was laid off, Ub Iwerks was canned as well. Walt proposed that the two should start their own art shop. Ub signed on. They quickly got their first gig producing art for a restaurant industry publication. The company proposed paying them just $10 a week, but would also give them office space. It sounded like a deal. But when the two showed up, they were shown to their desks that were in a used bathroom. Yes, Walt Disney's first studio was in the latrine. Ub and Walt quickly got some jobs. But after a few months, Walt was offered employment at a company that created advertisements for theaters. It paid $35 a week, over double what he was making in his two-man studio. He'd be illustrating theater ads as well as producing both animated and live films. He decided to give it a try. The films they produced were crude. Walt would create two-dimensional puppets with joints that moved. He'd take pictures of the characters in different positions, then ran those pictures together to simulate movement. It was amateurish, but he was still getting his feet wet in animation. A few months in, Walt successfully lobbied for a job for Ub. At this film ad company, Walt wrote the scripts and would sometimes even appear in the commercials. In one instance, a car crashed in front of the company building, so the team had an idea. Walt followed a cameraman to the scene of the accident. He stood in front of the broken car, and the camera recorded Walt looking dazed near the wreckage. They then used the footage for an insurance company advertisement. It was around this time that he really fell in love with animation. He'd spend much of his spare time in dark movie theaters watching the animation that accompanied the feature films. The art form was relatively new, and all the innovators were based in New York City. Cartoons like Felix the Cat and Coco the Clown were taking animation into exciting new directions, and Walt wanted to learn everything that he could about it. He grabbed a copy of E.G. Lutz's influential 1920 book, Animated Cartoons. He devoured the contents of this book. Walt also found another seminal book, Animals in Locomotion, which included animals and humans photographed frame by frame in activities such as walking, jumping, and running. He was fascinated by the process of making things look like they were moving through a series of pictures. After about a year at the ad company, in early 1921, Walt started experimenting at home on his own. From his job at the film ad company, he had some money in his pocket and began channeling those funds into personal projects. This moonlighting led to the creation of his first real animated cartoon. It was a 2-minute and 25-second cartoon he called Local Happenings that featured a Kansas City police incident in a comical way. He showed the film to a local theater purveyor that owned 3 Kansas City movie houses. "I like it. Is it expensive?" the owner asked. Walt haphazardly responded, "No, sir. I can make it for 30 cents a foot." A foot meaning a foot of film. The owner quickly jumped on the deal, saying he could buy one a week. Walt was elated, but about an hour after the sale, he realized that he forgot to add in profit. 30 cents a foot was actually the cost of producing the cartoon. Nevertheless, he had his first cartoon distributor. On March 20th, 1921, Walt's first cartoon premiered in a Kansas City theater. He was just 19. Now, Walt was doing all of this as a moonlighting gig. He hadn't yet left the film ad company. He was itching to break out on his own, but he wanted to build a small nest egg before taking the plunge. By the spring of 1922, he decided to leave the film ad job to start his own animation studio. He cobbled together some investors, raised $2,500, and formed his company, Laugh-O-Gram Films Incorporated, on May 18, 1922. He brought on a team of people he met in the industry, but Ub Iwerks wasn't yet ready to leave his decent-paying job at the film ad company. Now, Walt's idea was to take fairy tale stories that were in the public domain and modernize them. He planned on creating his own cartoon shorts of Little Red Riding Hood, Jack and the Beanstalk, Goldilocks, Cinderella, and you get the picture. Within a matter of a few months, he landed his first deal with a Tennessee outfit called Pictorial Clubs. The agreement was that Walt's Laugh-O-Gram films would deliver cartoons to be shown in schools and non-theatrical venues. He thought he worked out a sweet arrangement because it still left him the opportunity to lease cartoons to theater chains to increase the profit on each film. In September 1922, the Tennessee company agreed to pay Walt $11,100 for 6 animated cartoons. But again, Walt showed signs of being more creative than a shrewd businessman. He agreed to take only $100 as a down payment, with the remaining $11,000 to come on January 1, 1924, over a year after he delivered the 6 cartoons to the company. Maybe he figured he'd also be able to license them to theaters to bridge the gap. But to this day, his reasoning behind the deal is unclear. Walt went to work on the project. He convinced his buddy, Ub Iwerks, to come on board to help produce the cartoons.
In those days, we didn't have very much money, and we had to find a very simple way to do these drawings so that we could get them out.
He was learning the process at lightning speed. He'd later reflect on the job of an animator.
An animator is an artist who makes the drawings move. He puts them through their paces. He's a combination of many things. First, he has to be a real student of art. Next, he has to be a clever draftsman. Then he must have the soul of an actor and the understanding of a director.
He was making progress on the cartoon, but within a few months, his bank account was approaching zero, and he was still over a year away from being paid the remaining $11,000 from the Tennessee outfit. Things got incredibly tight for the young entrepreneur, so tight that he began to miss payroll. To make the matter even worse, Walt receives some devastating news. The Tennessee outfit that hired Walt to make the six cartoons went bankrupt. Walt was out the $11,000. The business quickly began to unravel. Bills went unpaid, and collectors started circling the company. He missed payroll for weeks. For some employees, it was even months. They began to walk out. In early 1923, Walt tried to find other investors in his firm, but aside from a few sporadic loans, there were no takers. Things were getting dire.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So the company that hired Walt to create cartoons went bankrupt. The young cartoonist was out the $11,000 he was owed. The business quickly began to unravel. He missed payroll for weeks. For some employees, it was even months. They began to walk out. Things were getting dire. At one point, he connected with a dentist who wanted to hire Walt to create a film to educate children about dental care. The dentist agreed to pay him $500. One night, the dentist called Walt. "I've got the money. Come over and we'll set the deal," stated the dentist. Walt said he couldn't. When the dentist asked why, Walt responded, "I haven't any shoes." Apparently, Walt's only pair of shoes were falling apart and he couldn't afford new ones. So he left them with the shoemaker to be fixed. The problem was that by the time they were mended, Walt didn't have the dollar and a half to pay for the work. The shoemaker refused to give them to Walt until he received payment. So Walt was now shoeless. The dentist quickly went to the shoemaker, paid Walt's bill, delivered the shoes to Walt, then finalized their film deal. But with creditors piling up, the $500 payment went fast. Walt could no longer afford his $3 a month apartment and was evicted. So he slept at the studio for a while and took showers once a week at a local train station. Things were getting so bad that he couldn't even afford to eat 3 square meals a day. It was his darkest time. He had to rely on the generosity of a local inn to allow him to eat on credit. At one point, the innkeeper, who took a liking to Walt, informed him that his business partner was forcing him to cut Walt off. By chance, the innkeeper caught Walt rummaging through leftover scraps from a photography studio. The sight shook the innkeeper enough to override his business partner, and he told Walt to come over to his place to get something to eat. Walt decided to make a last-ditch effort for his company. In May 1923, he sent a letter to a woman named Margaret J. Winkler, one of the biggest distributors of cartoons in New York. Walt wrote, quote, "We have just discovered something new and clever in animated cartoons. It's a new idea that will appeal to all classes and is bound to be a winner because it's a clever combination of live characters and cartoons, using a cast of live child actors who carry on their action on cartoon scenes with cartoon characters," end quote. He said he'd send her a copy when it was done, if she'd like. Margaret Winkler responded, saying, quote, "If it is what you say, I shall be interested in contracting for a series of them," end quote. The response excited Walt. This was a major distributor of animation. He teamed up with Ub Iwerks, one of the few artists that stayed with him in his rough time, and the two went to work on the cartoon he entitled Alice's Wonderland. Walt made an appearance as the illustrator showing Alice through the weird cartoon world. Ub and a few of the other artists made cameos as well, and so did a cartoon mouse, but we'll get to that later. As they progressed on the cartoon, bill collectors began to clamp down on Walt. He ultimately lost his office space. Alice's Wonderland would go unfinished. His Hail Mary failed. To get some advice, Walt turned to his brother Roy, who was living in Los Angeles. Roy suggested he come out to California and live with their uncle that recently bought a home in Hollywood. Walt agreed. He sold some equipment and bought a train ticket heading west.
Well, I came to Hollywood and arrived here in August 1923 with $40 in my pocket and a coat and a pair of trousers that didn't match. One half of my suitcase had my shirts and underwear and things. The other half had my drawing materials.
Even after everything he'd been through, he felt happy and free. He had a rare quality that kept him confident in his ability. Walt still believed he'd make it big. But he did think his animation days were over.
Well, I tried to get a job doing anything I could in the studio so I could learn. I was a little discouraged with the cartoon at that time. I felt at that time that I was getting into it too late. In other words, I thought the cartoon business was established in such a way that there's no chance to break into it. So I tried to get a job in Hollywood, working in the picture business so I could learn it. I would have liked to have been a director or any part of that. And there was nothing open, so before I knew it, I had my drawing board out and I started back to the cartoon.
And he was pulled back for a reason. Shortly after he arrived in Hollywood, he reconnected with the New York animation distributor, Margaret Winkler, who was still interested in the Alice's Wonderland cartoon he pitched her. Walt sent Margaret his only copy. She reviewed it. And on October 15, 1923, Walt received a telegram from her offering him a contract for an Alice's Wonderland series.
And I was able to secure a contract for 12 of these short films.
She'd pay $1,500 per cartoon for the first six and $1,800 per cartoon for the second batch. And most importantly, she agreed to pay him on delivery of each film. There'd be no waiting period like the Tennessee company that stiffed him. That's all he needed to hear. Walt and his older brother Roy formed the Disney Brothers Studio the next day. Now, of course, they had to deliver the cartoons to Margaret before they got paid. So they had to get creative to bridge the gap.
In effect, the government helped subsidize us, and I'll explain that to you. My brother was a veteran of the First World War, and he would had been hospitalized and things, and so he was receiving a certain disability compensation that amounted to about $85 a month, and we lived on that while we established the studio.
Walt went to work on the Alice series.
And I did all the drawing myself. I had no help at all. I was all alone, but I made the first six practically alone. Then at that time, I was able to get some of the boys that had been with me in Kansas City to come out.
Ub Iwerks would eventually travel west to join his team.
So on, from the seventh on, I had some help, and I got by the first year, and they were fairly successful, and that led to other things.
By mid-1924, the demands of production forced Walt to make a decision.
And it reached a point that I had so many, working with me, and there's so much time and attention to demanded that I had to drop the drawing end of it myself.
He'd leave the drawing to talented artists like Ub. Walt would focus on writing, directing, and producing.
But I've never regretted it because drawing was always a means to an end with me. So through these other boys who were good draftsmen and artists in many different phases of the business, very talented people, coordinating their talents is what has built this business. And if I hadn't dropped the drawing end of it myself, I don't think I'd have built this organization.
While the team worked on the Alice comedy series, the business was growing. In 1925, he had a small staff of half a dozen people. One was an anchor and secretary named Lillian Bounds. She was a few years older than Walt. By mid-year, they were married. The following year, Walt and Roy moved the operation to a studio on Hyperion Avenue in Silver Lake, a borough of Los Angeles. Walt was building a family atmosphere within his company.
No one becomes a part of the group that isn't in sympathy with our ideals.
He loved the camaraderie of the business. Animation mainly attracted men, but women were also brought on board to help with inking and coloring. Around the move, they changed the name from Disney Brothers Cartoon Studio to the Walt Disney Studio. Walt was rightfully becoming the face of the organization, a position he didn't shy away from. Now, one thing that we should highlight here is Walt's relationship with his distribution partner in New York, Winkler Pictures.
On se connaît depuis peu de temps, et voilà que je ressens.
Margaret Winkler's company was just a middleman. The big kahuna in this whole operation was Universal Pictures, who contracted with Winkler Pictures to supply them cartoons, who then turned to Walt to actually create them. By 1927, Winkler Pictures thought the Alice comedy series was too expensive and time-consuming to produce, and they wanted something that could be turned around faster and cheaper. So they told Walt to come up with a new idea. Walt decided on a purely animated series.
And I'd been doing a rabbit. It was called Oswald the Rabbit. I did and started for him.
Winkler and Universal liked it, and Walt Disney Studios went to work. The first Oswald cartoon was released in September 1927, and it was an immediate hit. And of course, with success comes a whole new set of problems. You see, the middleman in the production of Oswald, Winkler Pictures, got greedy. Walt may have been the creator of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, but Universal actually owned the character. So Winkler decided they were going to take advantage of that loophole.
And he was a rather unscrupulous character, and he thought he could cut in and move in a little better, and I pulled away from him, and I was left alone, and he happened to own the character. He had a right to the character.
Winkler signed another contract with Universal Pictures in February 1928 to deliver Oswald cartoons, and then decided to cut Walt out. A representative for Winkler began secretly contacting Walt's artist, offering them a pay raise to jump ship and come to Winkler to produce Oswald. Ub Iwerks got the call as well, but Ub was loyal to Walt. He promptly turned to his friend to inform him that trouble was brewing.
Je n'ai pas su résister, c'est facile à aimer. Je n'ai pas su résister, c'est facile à aimer.
Walt had a hard time believing his team would leave him, and this was also a touchy time financially. Disney Studios had a staff of nearly a few dozen people and had moved to a bigger office. If they were to lose their biggest project, it would thrust Walt into financial peril again. So he hopped on the train to New York to meet with Winkler Pictures. And sure enough, Ub was right. Winkler informed Walt that they were not going to be renewing the contract. Walt was stunned.
So that was one of the big lessons I learned. And from then on, I said, there's no middleman. He contributed nothing. We did everything. So I had to get a new character.
On March 13th, 1928, Walt and his wife Lily boarded a train in New York for the long trip back to Los Angeles, determined to come up with a new idea. Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So Walt was told by his New York distributor that they were no longer going to be working with him to produce Oswald the Lucky Rabbit cartoons. He was stunned by the news. On March 13th, 1928, Walt and his wife Lily boarded a train in New York for the long trip back to Los Angeles, determined to come up with a new idea.
So I had to have a new character. I'd always, I'd fool around a lot with little mice, and they were always cute characters, and they hadn't been overdone in the picture field. They'd been used, but never featured. So I decided it would be with a mouse. Oh, and then the name came, what would you call him, and the euphony there of Mickey Mouse, and I had a Mortimer first, and my wife shook her head, and then I tried Mickey, and she nodded the other way, and that was it.
When Walt returned, he had Ub Iwerks draw up the mouse. It looked strikingly similar to Oswald the Rabbit, but instead of long droopy ears, the mouse had circular ears and a more protruding nose. About 2 months after his fallout with Winkler Pictures, Walt introduced the first Mickey Mouse cartoon called Plane Crazy. It wasn't well received, and he couldn't find a distributor. He created another, and again, couldn't find a distributor. It was looking like deja vu. Walt needed a new idea.
It just so happened that 2 years earlier, one of his main competitors produced a cartoon called My Old Kentucky Home. The animation included, for the first time, synchronized sound. The following year, the first American feature-length movie with sound, The Jazz Singer, was released. The success of the film pushed most U.S. theaters to install sound systems. The technology was ripe to be exploited. Walt decided he needed something to make Mickey Mouse stand out. That was it. Sound. So he worked with Ub Iwerks to produce a new Mickey Mouse cartoon with sound called Steamboat Willie. And this one found a distributor. On November 18th, 1928, Steamboat Willie debuted in New York. audience was mesmerized by Walt's new cartoon. One person from the crowd even asked the projectionist to delay the feature movie so that they could replay the cartoon. The verdict was in, and Walt Disney immediately knew what direction to take the young company.
So we decided that there's no sense in making anything more silent, and we immediately switched to sound, and we didn't have any sound equipment or anything else, but we went ahead and made them for sound, and we eventually got sound on them, and of course, it, I think, played the big part in establishing Mickey Mouse.
In 1929, they added a voice to Mickey, and of course, Walt stepped in.
Well, it's just the falsetto, and we were fooling around and trying to get a voice for a mouse, and nobody knew what a mouse would sound like, so I said, well, it's kind of like this. And the guy said, well, why don't you do it? And I knew I'd always be on the payroll, so I did it.
Mickey Mouse quickly became a phenomenon. By early January 1930, the first official theater-based Mickey Mouse Club commenced at a California theater. 2 months later, 60 theaters were operating Mickey Mouse Clubs. A few months after that, the club expanded to hundreds of theaters. By mid-1932, membership to the theater-based Mickey Mouse Clubs in the U.S. reached 1 million. Walt Disney's cartoons were exploding in popularity, and this was all happening in the midst of the Great Depression. Not even the biggest financial crisis in America's history could slow his creativity down. Walt would go on to make other Mickey Mouse shorts, and in 1932, he began producing his musical cartoons, Silly Symphonies, in Technicolor. Now, cartoons at the time were all short 6 to 8 minute animations that were typically played before a feature-length live-action film. The success of Walt Disney's short cartoons presented him with a new opportunity. Walt wanted to create America's first feature-length cartoon, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. In 1937, he talked about this monumental undertaking.
We've been at it for the past 2 years. We won't be finished completely with Snow White until sometime early next year. You see, Elsa, it's going to run 10 reels, which means the showing time of 1.5 hours. No cartoon production has ever run that long before.
It was one thing to produce a 6 to 8 minute cartoon. It was a completely different endeavor to make a feature-length animated film that holds the attention of an audience. Walt discussed the challenges.
Well, we have to create personalities out of line drawings. For example, if we were making Snow White with living actors, we could turn the story over to them and each actor would introduce bits of business which would build up the character he was playing. But with our little characters, we have to plan out every movement that they make, even to the wink of the eye. In other words, we have to literally pull everything out of the air, and then with a pencil and paper, we start building a picture.
Walt, how many people do you have working at your studio?
500. 250 are working on Snow White, and the rest of them are working on the short subjects.
When we get into things like Snow White and these feature cartoons where you have the human anatomy to contend with, we do use models, and we do put them in the wardrobe and things, and we do photograph them, but it's more to set a guide. It's like any artist using a model, except we're using them in motion. Now, it's awful hard to visualize the graceful maneuvers of the female figure. For my artists, we used to sit down there and they would go through the actions and look at themselves in a mirror, you see? And I said, I've got to get away from that because they were poor actors, you see? Now, by having a model and everything, she will go through the gestures and things, but we don't copy, we don't trace. That is more an inspiration. Then we take our own latitude from that. But it is sort of a thing that stimulates the imagination of the artist. It can be like giving you an idea of what this character ought to do, too, you see? Because we got a problem of starting with a blank piece of paper. And then we've got to take these with our pencil. We've got to make them have personality and life and proper movement. Well, that's an awful lot for you to sit down in the room and think about and try to work out, you know?
The extraordinary cost for the feature-length cartoon led critics to dub the film Disney's Folly before it was even released. But when Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs premiered on December 21, 1937, the naysayers went silent.
Slave in the magic mirror, come from the farthest space. Through wind and darkness I summon thee. Speak! Let me see thy face.
What wouldst thou know, my queen?
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all?
Famed is thy beauty, Majesty, but hold, a lovely maid I see. Rags cannot hide her gentle grace. Alas, she is more fair than thee.
It was a massive critical success. The New York Times actually thanked Walt Disney, and a few days after its release, Snow White and the Dwarfs appeared on the cover of Time magazine. It also broke box office records, becoming the most successful sound movie of all time. And it was a smash hit with international audiences as well. Walt garnered global fame. He became an accidental Hollywood tycoon. Yet the film industry didn't really know how to handle his work. Showing the industry's early bias towards live action, Snow White was not nominated for the 1938 Academy Awards Best Picture. Instead, the Academy gave the movie an honorary Oscar, which was presented to Walt Disney by Shirley Temple.
I'm sure the boys and girls in the whole world are going to be very happy when they find out the daddy of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Mickey Mouse, Ferdinand, and all the others, is going to get this beautiful statue. Isn't it bright and shiny?
Oh, it's beautiful.
Aren't you proud of it, Mr. Disney?
Well, I'm so proud, I think I'll bust.
With the success of Snow White, Disney's Hyperion studio was becoming too small. The staff was bursting at the seams. During production of Snow White, some artists were packed 6 people deep into an office. So Walt scoped out a place in Burbank, California, just north of the Hollywood Hills, to accommodate his growing empire. Walt wanted to create a workers' paradise by building a studio from the ground up. He envisioned a place that workers would almost never have to leave, with a gym, baseball diamond, barbershop, and cafeteria that offered delivery service. It was an ambitious idea, fraught with problems because the Hyperion location still had a family-style vibe. The Burbank studio would be something different. Unlike Hyperion, where all facets of animation production were co-located, the Burbank studio would dedicate entire buildings to just one department of the animation process. Nevertheless, the studio was growing so quickly that Walt and Roy needed a larger facility, and they needed it yesterday. So they moved forward with building the grounds. On the day after Christmas 1939, some of the Disney staff began the move from Hyperion to Burbank. Walt Disney had become a major player in Hollywood. He bumbled around for several years trying to find his way in the growing art form of animation. Walt faced some unscrupulous characters that plunged him into deep debt. Things got so bad for Walt that he had no shoes and resorted to eating leftover scraps. He was forced to close shop and move west to his uncle's Hollywood home. He thought he'd missed the boat in the burgeoning animation industry, but he kept to it and finally landed a financially rewarding deal in the creation of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. He faced near extinction again when a distributor plucked his staff to create the Oswald character without him, but his storytelling genius proved to be his saving grace. He created Mickey Mouse that became an international phenomenon. Walt innovated again with America's first feature-length animated film, Snow White. He was becoming a master storyteller, the likes of which the world had never seen. The boy from Missouri had made it. But what Walt couldn't have seen when opening his Burbank studio in 1940 was that trouble was brewing. A political force had been quietly infiltrating Hollywood. This un-American movement was inspired by a utopian novel, a novel that provided a roadmap for a socialist takeover of America, and Hollywood was one of their biggest targets. Next time on Red-Pilled America.
That's when Walt Disney formed a conservative group to stop the socialist takeover of Hollywood.
And he evidently heard that I had call them all a bunch of communists, and I believe they are.
I would move to the state of Texas if it ever came here, because I think the Texans would kill them on sight.
We have been eminently successful in preventing them from their usual tactic of trying to run a majority of an organization with a well-organized minority.
And that's how they've done it. That's how the far left has taken over American culture. But there's a way to stop them.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Informed Ventures. Thanks for listening.